Tonight we're going to go back with our good friend Bill Friedman, and we're going to find all about how Al Capone got his scar and how he ended up in Chicago from New York City.
You put 50,000 in cash money in the slot, right?
300 Quaker, probably in the slot, I'm up to 0.
They steal the door, they turn it to change.
Okay, I'm on the northbound access. Just right at the light.
Look, Captain Carl, what's the house going to do? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome back to Studio 4, the beautiful Ice House in Midtown Kansas City, right here where the Big Dumb Fun Show is recorded and goes out live every Monday night. From 7 to 10, yeah, Aaron. You know, I haven't asked you about the Big Dumb Fun Show. I'm good. I'm here with my good friend, co-host Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, Aaron, tell us a little bit about the Big Dumb Fun Show.
No, I just did. I blew the whole hello, Aaron part. We're going to have to edit that out. Try that again.
No, it'll be fun. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron. So we'll cut all that out. The Big Dumb Fun Show at BigDumbFunShow.com is a drive-time style trending talk, independent, unsigned music, radio, television program that's live from 7 to 10 on Mondays. And then you can download the podcast. It's at BigDumbFunShow.podbean.com. You can watch video. We post up at YouTube, which is, of course, youtube.com/BigDumbFunShow. And you can follow our sweet, sweet tweets at twitter.com/BigDumbFunShow.
Thanks, Aaron. You know, I need to say thank you to a few folks. You know, we had our friend Colin Cardinal, I believe, from Canada, who I sent something up to. The only time I probably will send something out of the country, because it costs more than it's worth to send a book or a movie or something like that out of the country. My good friend Barry Parks from up in Smithville. We got Myra Watson. We got Jonathan Taylor, whose wife works at First Call. And we have Austin. I'm sorry, Austin. I know your last name is Vonaroff. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. I hope I'm right. He called me the other day, and we had a nice long chat about organized crime in the Midwest particularly, which is kind of what we tend to specialize in, that and things I've been involved with or things that other people have been involved with, where it be a skyjacker from St. Louis and Detroit, or a sting expert from Overland Park, Kansas, who did all of his sting operations out in the southwest part of the United States.
Or an actual police officer.
There's a few actual police officers. Our good friend David Barton and David Starbuck. Our good friend Terrence O'Malley, who is an expert on Union Station Massacre, actually.
And a lot of good authors as well.
And we have a lot of good authors. And we've got one of them here tonight. We've got Bill Friedman with us here tonight. Bill, say hello.
Hello. Good being here.
Bill, we're talking a little bit about Al Capone tonight. Aaron and I were talking about this before. So you have set up that the scenario that there was it was really based on prostitution and then prohibition and illegal alcohol, an organized criminal gang, a syndicate, started out of the south side of Chicago. They started this long-held tradition of corruption between the governor, the mayor, and the chief of police, and the Cook County sheriff, usually, in Chicago. And that's the scene that Al Capone steps into. So how did Al Capone ended up in Chicago? He was from New York.
Well, when he arrived in 1920, at the time just before Prohibition went into effect, it had been a prostitution group, and it was started by a man by the name of Big Jim Colosimo, and he married a brothel madam, and they had a couple of brothels, and he became the bag man between all the brothel areas in that area of the city, and both the police and the politicians. And when extortionist groups started threatening him for payoffs, he brought in his nephew from a New York street gang by the name of Johnny Torrio, and he took over the operation. Well, Capone also ended up in a gang connected to the one Torrio had been in. And one night he was playing pool and he got in an argument with somebody and he slugged him, and the person went down and he ran home and got a phone call that was incorrect that he'd killed the guy. He had not. So he called his gang's boss, and the boss knew Torrio, and he said, I got to get out of town. And so he asked Torrio if he could use someone. He said, well, I can always use a bodyguard and a driver, and so send him out. And they hadn't met before, and he became the bodyguard and driver of Torrio and soon was running one of his brothels. And Prohibition started, and Colosimo had no interest in it. He had his two brothels. He had a very high-end nightclub and illegal casino called Colosimo's Cafe. And at that point, he had a new 19-year-old bride that was taking all of his time and attention. Well, Torrio and Capone, who became great, very close, were very ambitious. They wanted to go into Prohibition. Not only didn't Colosimo need the money, but he didn't have contacts with federal officials and thought that was a good way to go to jail. Well, the other two, they wanted to get into Prohibition, but he was their boss. And Torrio, because Colosimo was so busy with his cafe and his wife, he had taken over the operation of the brothels. He'd taken over bagging the money for all the brothel operators. He knew how to do everything. So one day when Colosimo in the afternoon walked into the front of the cafe by himself, a shooter had been waiting, came out, shot him twice, and was gone before anyone got there. There's no smoking gun that says it has to be them, but it's quite clear they were the only beneficiaries. Whoever was there knew his routine. They knew how to handle it. There's never been any doubt in anyone's mind that the two of them took out the Torrio's uncle, and then they quickly went into Prohibition. Well, the situation in Chicago with Capone, now the lieutenant, was that they had the political connections that they basically ran crime in the south half of town. But there was some small groups in that area. So for the next 4 years, they systematically got in a gang war with each of these small groups till they'd wiped them out. They didn't go after the bigger groups in the north because there was a man in town, a Sicilian by the name of Mike Merlot, and he was a phenomenal human being, had seven children, started something like 10 businesses, and everybody of every nationality loved this man. He had very fine values, very fair person, hated violence, preached to the gang members, gang leaders against it, couldn't stop the small gangs from fighting, but he kept the big gangs from fighting so that there was peace between the Northsiders and the Southsiders.
So was he involved in the rackets also?
No, he was a completely legitimate guy. When he died because of surgery complications, just humongous numbers of people showed up. I mean, he was one of these great individuals who not only was a benefit to the community, but he had that incredible ability of talking to these mobsters who were violent and preaching not to do it. And before we go ahead with his important role, it's also important to bring in the fact that when we're dealing with vice versus other crimes that aren't so open, Torrio had the south half of town, and they had a very corrupt mayor by the name of Bill Thompson. 4 years, I'm not sure of the year now, that's not relevant. Another man was elected mayor by the name of Thiever. And
did you say Thiever?
Yeah, William Thiever, D-E-V-E-R.
Thiever.
And he was elected mayor, and he was an honest man, and he appointed an honest police commissioner. Now, here is a town that is one of the most notoriously wide open in the country. Obviously, many police were on the payroll, but Thiever's police chief said very simply to his officers, if I find within a certain period of time there is any open vice, you're gone. I don't care what your values are, what your friendships are. You do your job, you're gone. These two men single-handedly closed Chicago down. So Torrio had to move out of town into the nearby cities. And at that point, we're talking about early 1920s, cars were becoming affordable for the average person. People were on the roads, and restaurants started opening up on highways. Well, Torrio became the first person to open up highway vice. He opened up speakeasies that either had a large brothel or a casino on top, and he put them out on the highways where it didn't cost a lot to get the local politicians and police involved. And then he ran wires from his places a few miles to gas stations or other facilities that were on the road. And when a police car would go by, they'd push a buzzer and the brothel or the casino would be empty when the police arrived. And he started in these little hamlets, but when Thiever completely closed him down, he went into the city of Cicero. And the way he did it is most interesting. You know, I've spent my orientation is the Nevada casino industry, but I've had to study some of these major gangs across the country because they came in and built casinos in Nevada. And one of the things I learned, because after Prohibition, the major gangs in Prohibition, the four biggest gangs, they opened wide open but illegal casinos, very high-end, more elegant than anything on the Strip today, for the next decade plus until they decided to move into Vegas. And they would partner with people in other areas, but the local guy ran everything. The police and politicians wanted someone in town who they could go to with problems. If they developed, they wanted someone they could hold accountable. So the local owner ran everything. Investigations have gotten confused about what these power structures were, like there was a national gang. There never was. The local guy ran it. If you don't have the police or politicians on your side, there is no chance you can go into a town with force and take it over. I know it occurs in the movies, but there's never been a single case in the United States. Our laws are strong enough with honest officials that anything can be stopped.
When they moved to Cicero then, so this is how Capone ended up starting in Cicero. They moved to Cicero, they must have been able to, which was a separate city from Chicago back then, they must have been able to buy off the police
the reason why I gave you this is what Torrio did. He was the boss at that time, and Capone is the lieutenant, appeared to be totally insane. He drives into Cicero knowing nobody, having no control. He drives in with a couple cars full of painted ladies. They pull up to a place he'd rented. They go up to the second floor with beds and everything that they need, and the girls start preparing everything. And Torrio walks to the end of the block and stands on the corner and watches. And sure enough, within a period of time, the police show up. They arrest the girls. They take all the new furniture, throw it out the window, and make sure they break it as it falls. They shut the place down. The next day, he does the exact same thing at another location a few blocks away. Well, everyone thought the man was crazy. This is just insane. The next day, the police are the ones that closed him down. The next day, the sheriff of Cook County, where Chicago and Cicero are, he shows up to the number one gangster in town that controls the politicians and all crime, and everything goes through him. He has a slot arcade with 500 machines in it. Sheriff raids his place. They're pulling all the equipment out, seizing it. As they're doing this, Torrio walks in, looks around to see what's going on, walks up to the gangster, introduces himself, and he says, "You have the police chief. I have the sheriff. If I don't get brothels, no one's getting slot machines." So they cut a deal right then and there. Problem was, the politicians didn't want brothels. So the deal was he would get speakeasies and casinos in return for pulling the sheriff off. And that's how they went into Cicero. And he had to move his whole operation in there because he was completely shut down in Chicago. And he had the operation there. Now we get back to Mike Merlo. He got into disagreements because the biggest Northside gang, which was Dion O'Banion, he had some interest in Cicero too. And they were disputing. And so Merlo sat the two down, said, "You guys got to work together." He got them to open up as equal partners a major beer brewery for both their operations and to sell to other people. And they appeared to be getting along fine. O'Banion had a flower shop, and every time one of their Capone's people got shot, they bought humongously large bouquets from him. His people, O'Banion's people, used to hang out at the main speakeasy of Capone. Well, it was Torrio at the time. They'd go in unarmed and sit there and drink. They appeared to be getting along fine. At one point, there was a raid of 30 police officers of their brewery, and they arrested both Torrio and O'Banion working side by side on the bottling line. But the moment that Merlo died, someone called in O'Banion's flower shop, and remember what money was worth back then. It's probably worth 20 times more today. They ordered a $10,000 bouquet.
God, that would be like, what, $200,000 bouquet. Wow.
Yes. And
he probably went to work on that one right away.
And
did he take a check, or was that a cash on
those kinds of bouquets were always cash.
Cash on delivery, I could imagine. Yeah.
Not on delivery. What do you mean? Like, I'd get the cash and then I'd deliver it.
With Prohibition money. You know, there's a lot of money in Prohibition. That's really is what created the modern day, you know, La Cosa Nostra organized crime outfit, was all that money out of Prohibition.
Yeah, Prohibition turned local street gangs into major organized crime.
Well,
pure and simple, it was the profits that did it. And, you know, having to move all this liquid and protect it. But
they were in a perfect position because they were running the brothels, so they already had an illegal operation where they could sell liquor.
Oh, yeah. They had speakeasies and brothels. That's why Merlo came and said, "You guys need to produce it and work together and have a reason to protect each other."
Yeah, but...
even though O'Banion was Irish and in an Irish neighborhood, he absolutely loved and respected Merlo. He didn't deal with strangers. He was never alone with people that he was not close to. He was very upset about Marilow's passing and highly respected him. So when the people showed up the next day to pick up the bouquet, he was standing in the flower shop by himself. And of course, it was Torrio's people, and they shot him dead. And that started the big gang war of the time.
Was that primarily between Irish and Italian Sicilian, or was that were there?
Well, it was really the two gangs. Both gangs.
It was just the gangs. There might have been Irish in one, and even Eastern European and Jewish and Sicilian and Italian in both of them.
Yeah, there was a mixture. In other words, O'Banion had almost every gang in America came out of. Resulted from the newest immigrants because of their poverty who banded together, so it was almost always one nationality. O'Banion had a few different nationalities in his, even though he was in an Irish neighborhood, and the Torrio and Capone, the only good thing I can tell you about them, they were one of the four major gangs that had nationality, mixed nationalities in both the leadership and the membership. That's about the only good thing I can tell you. In fact, both Torrio and Capone were married to Irish women.
Interesting. And, I guess that would mean that would make sense why maybe Chicago once calls themselves the Outfit rather than La Cosa Nostra. Where back east, they refer themselves many times as La Cosa Nostra, and there's not quite so much mixing of races, shall we say. Maybe that's a bad way to put it, but mixing of ethnicities.
You're absolutely right. What we call a mafia gang, they brought the values of the mafia from Sicily, whereas the Capone people, they clearly were an organized crime group, but they didn't adhere to any of the things that would be specifically mafia. So you had these two groups, and it became known as the Beer War, and went on for a considerable length of time. And everybody thought it was over prohibition, but it wasn't. What it was is O'Banion had said publicly, "I'm as bad as Capone except for one thing. I will not let the women in my territory be abused by anybody." And Torrio came to O'Banion and said, "I'll build brothels just like we've got our Theban brewery. And we'll be partners." He said, "I don't want any money from women." So Torrio came back with another proposal, said, "I'll build brothels and I'll let you have speakeasies in my area. And I'll keep all the money from the brothels and you keep the money from your speakeasies." He said, "I don't allow anyone to abuse women. There will be no prostitution in my section of town." This was a moral issue fighting for this war, not booze, even though it was in the middle of prohibition. Well, that set off a long-term war, and they went back and forth. There were many attempts on Capone's life. They never hit him, although they shot at him many times. He took out the first successor to O'Banion. The police took out the next successor, and we end up with my mind's just slipping. I'm thinking of Weiss, who's number two. We end up with Bugs Moran. He's number four, and they're still very much at odds with each other. There was a number of factors. Capone wasn't interested in really going after Capone, after Moran. But two other people that he was associated with, there was a Sicilian society in America. It was a fraternal thing. It had nothing to do with crime. It was called Unione Siciliana, meaning the Union of Sicily. And this was where, in Sicilian neighborhoods, this is where you went when you had any problem, and people at all levels of society, from the rich, the politicians, all down to the people looking for a job, they were all members. So it made them very powerful in the neighborhood, and also anyone who was president controlled the vote. And during Prohibition, the gangsters realized that this could be a tremendous coup, and they started taking over the various branches, and then they started killing each other, and it is unbelievable. Everyone talks about Prohibition, the killings over booze. It's unbelievable how many Unione Siciliana presidents were killed. I mean, just unbelievable.
What was that, and over political power then?
Yeah, political power, because political power allowed you the freedom to act and the freedom to block other people. And so this became the number one issue they fought over. Well, one of the Chicago branch presidents was killed, and the brother, it was killed by people close to Moran. The brother was outraged. He's yelling at Capone, who was then living in Miami, because the mayor was so out to get him, and he was living in Miami at the time running his operation. And also, a man who was the first one to use a machine gun in a killing in the United States and became famous as Machine Gun Jack McGurn, he was the number one bodyguard. It was a huge bodyguard staff for Capone. He was the head of that. He was the number one hitman. He was the key guy, and he was taking care of things in Chicago for Capone. Well, the three top shooters for O'Banion had three times attacked him. And, I mean, these are really dramatic things where they've got him on the ground and they're firing machine guns at him and he's running, dodging, weaving. And although one time he got hit three times and almost died, he walked away from all three of them alive.
This all sounds a little bit like those old movies and even the Untouchables, whether it be sitting around in a joint or a restaurant or something, and a car would drive by and they would riddle the business with machine gun fire out of the car. Is that what you're talking about?
They were up close and personal. They caught him three times. Now, twice he was in a vehicle.
No, these
but
were...
they forced him off and he started running, and they're all shooting at him up close and personal.
Wow.
And one time he was walking out of his mother's home, and there's four guys in the alley back there, and he just outran it. I mean, it's one, you know, it's like one of these miraculous things three times in a row. You know, in other words, very dramatic up close shooting. One of them, he was in front of a building, and the wall is so shot up, it's impossible to figure out how he survived. Obviously, he was moving and the machine guns were moving, because there's no area of that wall where a human being would fit that it wasn't shot. But he was on the move. Well, he jumped on the bandwagon, and between the two of them, they convinced him to pull off the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Now, I was thinking we were getting pretty close to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre here.
Because one of them wanted the three key shooters. All of them wanted the leadership. There was a place where they repaired their trucks, and they got a group. They wanted all people out of Chicago to do the shooting, because they didn't want anyone that witnesses could look at police mugshots and pick out.
So Capone. Capone orchestrated this, or was it Machine Gun Jack McGurn that orchestrated it?
Capone approved it. McGurn went to see him. Capone approved it. It was completely McGurn's operation.
Now, was that because Capone at this point really kind of had taken control of the outfit, in that Johnny Torrio had actually been shot and was in the hospital?
the day they shot O'Banion, O'Banion's successor, Weiss, swore the next day he would get Torrio. A month later, Torrio returned to town. He came home shopping with his wife, was walking into the home, and three men from ambush came out and shot him three times. He also was facing a nine-month jail sentence for the time that O'Banion and he were arrested together. He suffered a lot from the shooting as he was recovering. He told the judge, forget the time you gave me. I'm going in, getting it over with. Left town the day he got out of jail, and he gave everything to Capone. So the guy that started the war, once someone shot at him, he was gone. And he moved back to a smaller town in New York.
So that left an opening for Capone then just step in and take over.
Yeah, gave it to him totally, and Capone just went on with his policies. And Capone did want to take over the town.
And then part of his way of taking over the town then would have been to go ahead and set this up to take out the competition, Dion O'Banion, and his crew.
But what I want you to understand, it all started from the brother who was so angry, you know, the president of the Unione Siciliana. He was the main driving force, and then McGurn was the second force, and Capone, they were in constant competition with each other, the Northsiders and Capone, but they were the motivating force, and he had good reason, and he finally said, let's do this thing. They wanted out-of-towners to do it, and not too far from you guys, in the city of St. Louis, was a very tough street gang by the name of Egan's Rats. And they did some work for Capone and other people. They had real bad dudes with them. One of them had become a division leader for Capone, and he brought in the rest of them. They had two guys in a apartment on the second floor across from the garage waiting for Moran to show up. In the meantime, they took two vehicles and made them look like detective cars and, you know, put bells on them, lights on them, the whole works. When they got the phone call that day that they thought Moran was there, we think that it was one of his division leaders they mistaken him for, because Moran was not there. They pulled out of their place. One of the cars went in back so no one could run away and just sat there. No one got out. The first vehicle pulled up. It had two guys in fake cop uniforms driving and three guys in the back seat in plain clothes. Well, the two, and I'm going to call them cops, but they're fake cops, they walk in like it's a normal harassment bust, and there's seven people in there. One is a doctor who just loves hanging out with gangsters. One is the mechanic. The three shooters are there, and there's two division leaders, two key division leaders. So they tell them to line up on the wall, and of course, massive machine gun fire. They pull from their coats this, they didn't do it. I take it back. They're holding the pistols. The three guys in suits, and it's February in heavy overcoats, they come in with machine guns underneath their coats, and they just riddle these seven guys. And I meant, you know, the number of shots fired is absolutely phenomenal. There's no way anyone's going to survive this. Then they go out with, they give the guns to the two fake cops. They go out with their hands in the air, the three guys in suits. The two guys that look like cops put them in the back seat. They get in and drive away. And there was, by then, many witnesses. But everything looked like a normal arrest, and then they found out what happened. Basically, it destroyed Moran's group. He had people left, but he was a small potato after that. But this set off a lot of problems for Capone. First of all, the police and the mayor had to, he'd reopened the town again with under Thompson, but they had covered their own image, so they closed him down. But the underworld decided to sanction Capone. And we had three groups that were by far, and I mean they were so much bigger than anyone else in Prohibition. Two of them didn't do the moonshine bit. Only one of them did. The two biggest didn't. But the three of them imported the finest liquors of the world, the most expensive there were. Two of them were based in Manhattan, because Manhattan was where over a half of the wealth of the nation lived. The other one was based in Cleveland. And these, it was the people from these gangs who built the Las Vegas Strip. They were still there when I entered the business, and they had a great impact on me personally and my career. It became a phenomenal story, what these guys did for me. And that's how I got in to put all this together. So the two gangs in New York, one of them, the partnership, was Charlie Luciano, who was the most powerful gangster in the history of the country, Ben Siegel, Meyer Lansky, Joe Adonis, and Vincent Allo, who everybody knew as Jimmy Blue Eyes. I was very close to him, and I think I may be the only guy that knew his real name. The whole world knew him as Jimmy Blue Eyes. They were the biggest. The second biggest was headed by Frank Costello. And Costello became the boss of bosses. He was over this 20-year period where these three gangs and the leaders of these three gangs and their close associates built 80% of the developing Las Vegas Strip. Costello built the Tropicana, one of the few that's still there. Siegel built the Flamingo, which is still there. And in the Midwest was Mo Dalitz, who became the most powerful criminal to come to Vegas. And he built the Desert Inn, which was the greatest and first high-rolling place.
So did Mo Dalitz came out of Cleveland, right?
Right.
So now he was his basis in this prohibition in beer, brewing beer and bringing beer across from Canada and alcohol across from Canada and distribute it down in the United States. Is that where his kind of basis in criminal activity came from?
He was number three, the biggest in importing, where they brought it across the ocean, and then high-speed boats took it from the international water line, and they brought it into Manhattan. They sold only in Manhattan. They may have distributed some of it, but it was basically Manhattan. Mo brought it into Cleveland, and he distributed it all over the Midwest. And Capone was one of his big customers.
So, yeah, that
Capone
was...
had his own thing from the Caribbean, but Mo was the big guy in this thing.
So that's my question then. Capone fit into this. This is like this is the national commission you're talking about, actually. And
the National Crime Syndicate.
National Crime Syndicate. And so where was Capone? He had taken over Chicago, and he was making a lot of money. He had a huge distribution network set up. I know we got what they call Capone beer down in Kansas City during Prohibition. So how did he fit in with that, with Mo Dalitz and them? Was that his connection?
It wasn't national. These guys were all territorial, but they dealt with each other. In other words, the three big gangs, those seven leaders, they had, you know, they just absolutely admired each other. They had the same values, and they allied with each other, but their values were they were businessmen, and they hated violence. They preached their whole careers against violence. They said there's enough for everybody. They preached against vendetta. They said this is crazy. All it does is vendetta makes the entire world blind. They said every time you kill someone, they have brothers. It makes the world more dangerous, not safer. They oppose monopoly. They fought against monopoly. When they took over a territory and opened it to gaming, they invited everybody in. They didn't fight anybody, and they could have kept it closed up without violence. Once they owned the police, they didn't have to threaten anyone. They just go tell the police to close them down. The police look good, and they are rid of a competitor. So they, how they got to the top is an amazing story, which is all in my book, but 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. But they were businessmen, totally different, but they were so admired by the criminals, Capone and every one of his successors absolutely idolized these guys, even though their values were 100% the opposite. And so Mo dealt with them, with the booze he was bringing in through Canada. Joe Kennedy was importing the booze to Canada, and it didn't become illegal until the moment Mo picked it up on the shorelines of Lake Erie. And at that moment, it became against the law, but Kennedy could stand there and truthfully say, I did nothing wrong. So Mo became the biggest guy in Vegas. And these guys got together, and they said, after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, they said, this thing has to stop. And at that point, Luciano, who was revered by the underworld like no one in history. I mean, this man just stands so far above everybody else. When he was a lieutenant in the biggest mafia gang in America, not the leader, the lieutenant, he called a meeting in Atlantic City shortly after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and he invited every major gang. It is the only time in the history of America that all the nationalities got together. It's the only meeting. And the only purpose was to tell Capone to stop it. So once he's in this meeting, and they've got all these people surrounding him, three people sat at the table representing the big three gangs, Luciano, Costello, and Dalitz, the main leaders of their three gangs. And they faced down Capone, and they said to him, all of your killing is turning the people against us. We're heroes because we're supplying what they want. But you single-handedly are turning the people against us. And because of that, the police and the politicians, we're all going to get busted. We're all going to lose our businesses, and you have to stop this. Well, he looked at what he was up against, and would have been Dalitz because he was the closest that would have been told, you go take him out. He said, they said, you have to stop this. He agreed. They said, you have to show us you mean this. You have to give us some kind of justification to believe in you. Well, the meeting ended with him saying, I'm going to back you 100%. He drove 60 miles from Atlantic City to Philadelphia with his bodyguard. It was 2 hours till the train they were going to take to Chicago. They went into a movie theater. As he's walking out, there's two detectives there. And Capone looks at them and he says, guys, I'm carrying a gun. And he pulls out a pistol and hands it to them. Two guys arrest him. He goes in. By morning, he had pled guilty, he and his bodyguard, because he wanted his bodyguard with him in the next cell in prison to protect him. They both pled guilty. Now, this was illegal search and seizure. They had no case at all. I mean, there was no one in America that didn't know this was a frame-up, did not know it wasn't a frame-up. And his attorney started to argue, and he said, I'm paying you, you keep your mouth shut. As he walked out in handcuffs, he said to the press, boy, the law acts fast here. Everyone knew it was a frame-up, but no one knew what went on in Atlantic City, so everybody wrote that he was being threatened by someone, he was a coward, and he was hiding out in prison. Because of that image problem, they they made three appeals, which any attorney would tell you have no hope because he pled guilty. Once you plead guilty, you can't say it was handled wrong. You're not going to get anywhere. But when he left prison 10 months later, he said, I tried every writ there was. All of it was imagery. Now, these are the important things. One, he knew the two detectives well. He pled guilty and got a year, 2 months off for good behavior. Nobody in the history of Philadelphia served a day in jail till that point for a hidden weapon. It was always a small fine. This thing was so obviously framed, but no one understood that the underworld had sanctioned him in the way the law couldn't.
So let me understand this, Bill. He framed himself, if you would, or he set himself up as a gesture that, okay, I hear what you're saying, and this is, I'm giving myself this penalty, and I'll do differently. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and it worked. There was two groups of Sicilian brothers. They just coincidentally had seven members in each one. Both of them sided with Capone, even though they were on the north side, for many years until they got in disputes over the presidency of the Unione Siciliana. Both of them turned against him because they wanted the presidency and Capone wanted his people to have the presidency. He killed most of both groups of the families. So one of the last remaining brothers, the Aola brothers, had gone to New York to hide out in Buffalo. And a week after Capone went to prison, to show you how strongly this was handled, here's the guy hiding for his life across the country. Aola shows up in Chicago with his wife, with his children, walking down the street with no bodyguards and goes back into competition with Capone, and no one disturbs him the whole time Capone's in jail and after he gets out. This thing, no one was kidding. This thing was not an image thing. This was for real. The killing stopped. However, something happened after Capone got out, and that I have never been able to figure out. They got into some dispute, and the old wars opened up again. And Capone finally beat these groups he was up against.
So he ends up the king of all of Chicago, so to speak.
Well, that's the way writers always write it because they didn't research it. They didn't know any of the people like I did. And they always write it that he was the king. But understand what happened. Hey, he took over in 1924. He had the south half of town. When he went into prison around 31, I'm not sure the exact date in my head, but when he went into prison on the IRS charges, he had only, with all of those killings, he had only taken over a third of the north side. There was a small gang there. The leader was called Terrible Roger Toohey, who had the west two-thirds of the north side. They tried to kill Capone a few times. Capone and his successors never retaliated. They were small, they were tough, and as bad as Capone's people were reputed to be, they would not go into mortal combat against this gang.
So it's a little bit like the White Sox and the Cubbies fans. It sounds to me like that's still going on, only it's just baseball today, the South Side and the North Side.
Yep. And it was, you know, later they took over, but nonviolently. But during his lifetime, all of the killing of Torrio and Capone from 1920 to about 1931 got them only 1/6 more of the town.
Interesting. Well,
I thought they...
Go ahead, Aaron.
They never got Torrio. Johnny Torrio got out.
He retired.
They did hit him, and he was injured, but he turned everything over to Al Capone and left the country.
He took a long vacation, but afterwards, in fact, I believe it was with one of the Aola brothers protecting him, but afterwards, he settled in White Plains, New York, and was a small guy in Prohibition kind of thing.
Well, they just can't stay away from it, can they?
Well, he had to make a living, but he did it where there was no conflict going on, and he had his business and, you know, got along.
Well, and he remained married to his wife, the second wife?
The 19-year-old wife?
No, that was Colosimo.
Oh, that was Colosimo. I'm getting my mobsters mixed up here.
Yeah, but Torrio was a family man. He went home at 5, 6 o'clock. He didn't drink. He didn't smoke. He didn't go out at night. Not your typical imagery. You know, but there was a few major gang leaders that were like that. But, you know, there was a lot that were not.
Yeah, you know, a lot like Nick Civella was like that, but his brother was not like that. His brother would be out in the joints, and his underboss, DeLuna, would be out in the joints, but Nick was never out at night. He was strictly business only.
Yep. It's amazing how different these people can be.
Well, I think that gets us to Capone, and kind of we don't need to go. We'll have to just reserve Frank Nitti and his successor for another time. Now, Frank Nitti is we all know him from the old Untouchables show. It seemed like there was more shows in about Frank Nitti than there was about Al Capone in that show. He's kind of a rising young star, and actually some of the more modern day mobsters in Chicago, Joey Iuppa and Tony Accardo, they came up under Capone. They were young gangsters under Capone and got their, earned their bones, made their bones, so to speak, back in those days.
Well, what's interesting about my book, for people that are interested in the Chicago thing, the first half of the book is about Prohibition, 14 years of Prohibition. And in it, I have everything we've been talking about with these first three gang leaders. The second half of the book, this all in one chapter about them, long chapter. But the second half of the book is about the casino empires that were built by the three biggest gangs. And Capone had some really classy casinos too. And he was the only other group to branch out across the U.S. And so that chapter gives the histories of Frank Nitti and the other two successors after Capone. They had very different lifestyles. They had very different leadership styles. They, you know, times change. They specialized in different businesses. And so that is a whole chapter in itself of those three leaders that followed Capone. And as you said, they were all there during Prohibition. But at the end of Prohibition, they branched out into very different businesses.
You know, and I have one question for you out of that. During Prohibition and Capone times, they used a lot of trucks to transport all this booze throughout the Midwest, and Chicago ended up one of their main areas that they went into after and during the war, right after the war, would have been into the Teamsters Union. And so did that, was that kind of a natural progression of events from the truck drivers that carried the booze on into the Teamsters Union?
Well, ironically, the Chicago benefited greatly from the Teamsters Union, but you know who was the one that got control of the pension fund, don't you?
Who's that?
Nick Civella.
Well, yeah, I mean, he had Roy Williams.
He was the guy who had, in other words, he had a good relationship with Chicago and other people, but understand that Nick called the shots of who would get the money and worked closely with Chicago and got them the money. But, you know, the guy that built the Landmark, Frank Carroll, he was a contractor from Kansas City. Civella made sure his friends were there as well as the other gangs that he dealt with. but it was Nick who was the man who put that package together. What happened, Chicago, as I said, Nick had the pension fund, but Chicago, they realized as when they knew the prohibition was going to be wound down, they had to find other sources of income, and they more than anyone else became labor racketeers, and both they took control over unions, bought out some of the leadership, threatened some of the leadership, and killed the rest of them. And then they exploited the workers, they exploited the businesses that had them. And the other big thing, which rarely gets any publicity, they not only threatened the businesses that had contracts with strikes, pay us under the table if you don't want to strike, but in addition, they created business associations. So they would have an association that would protect this business, type of business, or that type, and then they'd go in and threaten all the non-union owners that you either join it and pay us and give the and when they'd get all of one business to do it, they'd say, now raise all of you are going to pay, charge the same price. It'll be 50% more than anybody's charging now, and we get the 50%.
They did some of the same things down here in Kansas City. They like organized all the dry cleaners, and then they organized like the small theaters, a lot of small theaters. And if you didn't join, you got a, like your small theater, you got a smoke bomb in it, or your dry cleaners got some kind of a stuff in it that just would ruin all the clothes that they had hanging. So they all had to join up with those organizations and pay a little tribute back in the turn of the, I'd say right after World War II was when that really got started on up into the 50s. I think it all was kind of suspended after Prohibition. It got started, then the war came along and changed everything. And then they got back to business in 1945 or 46.
Yep.
Well, didn't the guys that were running the, in the Prohibition era that were, you know, they got together, they actually started a distillery or breweries. Once the Prohibition era ended and they repealed that act, didn't they just turn those into legitimate businesses?
Yeah, this is very interesting. When I told you these guys in the three big gangs were businessmen, when they saw that Prohibition was ending, they were already moving the good booze in. Okay, that was coming in. And what everybody else was selling was moonshine that was colored, but it was completely unaged. You know, all the wonderful things that when someone will talk about a good whiskey, this was just raw out of the vat booze that they colored, and it was rough. And now all of a sudden, these guys realize it's going to be legal. Only certain people can afford the really good stuff. The other people want aged stuff, and we don't have it. So until a few years go by and we get aged stuff, there's going to be a big market for moonshine. And they built, Bo Dalitz headed it, and all the guys I mentioned in New York joined it. But big time, the Chicago guys joined it. They were all very close. Even though they sent Capone to jail for a year, he continued to love them, work with them. Their successors did. Sam Giancana was a partner of Mo Dalitz, a hidden interest in the Stardust Hotel when it was the biggest in the world. They kept up these close ties. They were very close friends. Well, they built Dalitz with all these guys investing and heading it, built the biggest distillery in the history of America at that time. And he did everything legal but one thing. He put a counterfeit federal tax stamp on it. Now, if this had been Chicago, based on everything I know about them, they would have pocketed that as profit. I cannot imagine them passing it on to the consumer. Mo Dalitz was in control, and he was making as good booze as was out there, but he passed on by cutting his price, the amount he was saving on the tax stamp. As I said, they were businessmen. They weren't worried how much they made per bottle. They were worried how many bottles they sold. And 20 years before Sam Walton opened up the first Walmart, Mo Dalitz was selling discount booze across America. It was as good as anybody's and cheaper. And he was dominating the market.
Do you remember any of the trade names on that?
I got a couple in my book, but that was really hard to come by. You know, there's various places where I was able to really nail down that this is what they were calling it. And that one, I know the names of the companies. I got a hold of the incorporation papers, but I'm not quite sure what the brands were.
What the brands were. Well, maybe somebody out there that's listening to this, if you know what those brands were, why, get hold of me. Go on my website and just
leave a comment.
Leave a comment or
send an email.
Send an email or something. Maybe we'll find out what those were. That'd be kind of interesting. There's probably people that have those in their old collections of some kind with the labels on them of what.
They actually may have those as collectors unopened, even better.
Yeah, really.
Now, of course, folks can learn more about this, not only from listening to the podcast that we do, but also from reading Bill Friedman's book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip.
And you can get those at Amazon, or you can get those at Bill's website. And Bill, you have kind of I don't have it written down. Why don't you give your website again?
Actually, you can get them. You can get the print version at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's $17.99, and you can get the ebook at any retailer, and that's $4.99. But my website that describes the books and has my blog and all of that is Bill Friedman, Friedman, author.com.
Bill, do you still consulting with the casino industry and give do classes with or give conferences, not conferences, but seminars and stuff to people in the casino business?
Ironically, I just spoke at a convention at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where I taught for 10 years, many years ago. But I still consult on marketing, operations, and design. But I don't give, I'm still open. Anyone that's interested in the history of the business or the history of the people who built the business, yes, I still do that.
Did you ever know a guy named Dennis Gomes, G-O-M-E-S?
Oh, sure.
That went into the kind of the consulting business. I met him once. I was gonna interview him for my movie on the for Gangland Wire, because he was involved with the first uncovering of skimming with the rigged scales at the Stardust Casino. And so I was back in New York City, and he was in the process of actually buying with a partner an Atlantic City casino. He'd been consulting with them and helping people run their casinos for a long time. And so I went down and met him, really nice guy. And we were going to do an interview, and he died before natural causes, before I could get back around to interview. And he was really a nice guy.
For many years, I worked for the Howard Hughes Corporation, which was the biggest private company in the world, Summa Corporation. And I'm the only person that ever ran two casinos simultaneously on the Strip. One of them was called the Castaways, and the other was called the Silver Slipper. And while I was the president of both of those, he was in the casino between them called the Frontier as the casino manager. So, yes, I know him well. Knew him well, I should say.
He was quite a personality. He was a go-getter.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Aaron, you got anything else? Public interest announcement here?
I'm thinking Bill's got a couple of books. Not only does he
tell about that other book.
Yeah, you've got, because we had an interview with Bill on his other book on my program, The Big Dumb Fun Show, and we're definitely going to have to get him back. Usually when we have guests in, it's only maybe once a quarter. And I know Bill wanted to get together again. So we're going to, let's do this maybe in July on the Big Dumb Fun Show. We'll have you come on and we'll.
Against the law, right?
And we'll talk some more about that against the law.
Yeah. And it has the history, all against the law has the history of the first five mafia gang leaders in Kansas City.
It's an incredible amount of information. And Bill's book, Gary's got it, the 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. It's a solid book. I mean, it's just a dense volume of text with just an amazing amount of information. Gary's got notes sticking out of the book that he's got here in front of us. And
if you're a mob fan, a mob buff, and you want to really get down with details about these early gang leaders in the history of these guys who were really started the modern day crime families, the crime syndicate after the old Black Hander days and the old Mustache Pete's. Why, this is the book to get. It's got it all in there.
We thank you, Bill, for spending time with us and being on the program again.
And I thank you guys. It's always fun.
All right. Good night, Bill.
Good night.
Well, now we come to that time of the evening where we do a public service announcement. Just remember, if you have a friend, a relative, child, grandchild, a coworker, a boss, a parent, or anyone that you care about, actually a good friend, that has a problem with addiction, whether it be sex, drugs, or rock and roll, you know, opioid addiction is a big one today. They got a problem with taking too many of those painkillers, and a lot of people seem to have that. I don't really know much about it myself. The only thing I ever knew about was illegal drugs.
People don't think much about the fact that because it's a prescription medication, somehow it's not abuse.
Right, exactly. And people start taking that. I know a couple of people that have done that, and they start taking it because they had some kind of a pain, a back pain, or had a bad knee, one guy in particular. And the next thing he knew, a couple of years later, he's lost his job. He's living down the street from a meth dealer, and he's helping a dude sell meth, and he's doing meth and anything he can get his hands on. So it's a slippery slope, folks. And first call, you know anybody that's got that far down the path, or even if they're just starting down the path, or if you think you might be starting down the path yourself, if you have your prescription drugs and you can't hardly wait to get the prescription filled, or you're figured out ways to get it because you can't get it refilled again, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. If you're outside the area and you just want local resources in your area, call them anytime in the night or day. They will be able to steer you to somebody in your area, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. This kind of brings us to the end of the evening. Got anything else, Aaron?
Yeah, I was going to say, I need folks to remember to check out the documentary by Gary Jenkins, Gangland Wire. It's the documentary that started it all, and look for his book, which will be out maybe in
it'll probably be September time I get it through the different vetting processes. I've got another edit to put on it, pay somebody to edit, and I gotta pay somebody to be a beta reader. Anybody want to be a beta reader out there and give me feedback? Why, get hold of me. I'll send you the first four or five chapters, six chapters, if you'd read them and just get back with me and say, you know, I like this, I don't like this, this is confusing, that's confusing, well, I'd appreciate it.
And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. If there's anything else you can do, you could give us a comment, give us some feedback, go and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and give us a review.
Yeah, the more you subscribe, the more reviews we get, the higher we go up in the listings, and the more followers we get, and the more listeners we get, the more downloads we get, the closer we get to getting some kind of a sponsor, which will then allow us to increase our studio here and get more modern, up-to-date equipment.
Maybe actually get a real phone.
Get us a regular phone line in here.
A real Gangland Wire type, you know, right, phone, instead of this Magic Jack or Skype.
All right, that brings us to the end of this evening's storytelling. Look for our next episode. I just put one up. I put up another shorty that tells about some of the things we're going to be doing in the more near future. And so I'm saying goodnight, folks. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.